Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, April 1st, 2024. The headline from today's paper is, Legislators Face April Deadline to Lift Iowa's Statute of Limitations. Dateline Des Moines. Bill Vall fondly remembers growing up along Dubuque's bluffs. A love of the outdoors led him to join local Boy Scout Troop 23 of the Northeast Iowa Council in 1964 at the age of 11. Scouting provided opportunities for socializing and outdoor adventures, and Vall excelled, taking on leadership roles. An assistant scoutmaster, Kenny Krakow, took a liking to him and some of the other boys in the troop. Vall said Krakow would take him and a couple of other boys on outings outside the normal scouting schedule, on camping and canoe trips, to air shows and drag car and stock car races. He said Krakow often would offer to give him a ride home after scout meetings. Krakow would talk about girls, cars, Playboy magazine, and masturbation, like he was a teenager, Vall recalled. He would always make it very light and fun or entertaining, he said. We would park in front of my house, and we would talk more. Krakow eventually gained Vall's trust enough to persuade him to visit his house to look at magazines with nude girls and to race on the slot car track in his attic. Vall said he was drawn by Krakow's charm and generosity, but now recognizes the inappropriate nature of his actions. He said Krakow sexually abused him more than a dozen times from when he was about age 12 until he was 15. Vall said he never was able to tell his parents or anyone else what happened. Of course, at the time I was unaware I was being groomed, said Vall, 71, who now lives in Tucson, Arizona. All those activities were designed to make me feel greatly indebted to him. I had a bad relationship with my own father, and so I loved the attention, and we had a lot of fun. Vall said the alleged abuse went unreported until someone eventually turned in the assistant scoutmaster, whose name was included in the more than 20,000 pages of internal Boy Scouts of America documents dubbed the Perversion Files that detailed alleged sexual abuse by scout leaders. The files detail cases from 1959 to 1985. The records were used in a landmark 2010 court case over the abuse of six boys in a troop in Portland, Oregon, and were made public in 2012. In a letter sent to the National Boy Scouts organization in December 1970, a scout executive from the Northeast Iowa Council notified the Boy Scouts of America that Krakow, then 49, had resigned due to many years of homosexual activities with boys in the area. This fact he admitted freely to me in conference. We have taken appropriate action here, wrote Scout Executive Max Burgoyne in a letter included in the released files. Krakow had been a volunteer with the troop since 1938 and had served as scoutmaster previously. He died in 1980. Silent for most of his 71 years, Vall is in the final stages of submitting a package of documents to the Boy Scouts of America as part of a $2.7 billion plan to give the organization a pathway out of bankruptcy while compensating tens of thousands of sex abuse victims. The Boy Scouts of America filed for bankruptcy in 2020 after several states enacted laws letting accusers sue over decades-old abuse allegations. The organization ultimately reached a settlement approved in court in 2022 that would pay abuse victims amounts ranging from $3,500 to $2.7 million. The settlement involves more than 82,000 men who said they were abused as children by troop leaders. That fund, the largest of its kind in U.S. history to settle sexual abuse claims, distributing payments last fall to victims. But unless legislators take action this year to change Iowa law, the estimated roughly 300 to 350 Iowans involved in the settlement will receive a fraction of the awards they would be entitled to. Iowa officials in 2021 lifted the state's statute of limitations for bringing criminal charges in sexual abuse, incest, sexual exploitation, and human trafficking cases. but the law does not cover civil claims. Lawmakers face a looming deadline to lift Iowa's civil statute of limitations for filing sex abuse claims related to the Boy Scouts' bankruptcy and settlement. Iowa has 1 year from the effective date of the settlement trust, or April 19th, to change the law, or Iowa survivors will receive less than others across the country. When figuring victims' compensation, the settlement uses a matrix that weighs a variety of factors, including the type of abuse, how long it lasted, the effect it had, and whether the alleged abuser had other victims, whether the victim previously knew their alleged abuser, and different states' civil statutes of limitations. Iowa's statute of limitations requires victims of child sexual abuse to file cases in district courts by the age of 19 or within 4 years of coming to the realization as an adult that their injuries and suffering are related to their alleged abuse. Gillian Dumas is an Oregon attorney who is appealing the national settlement agreement and represents an Iowan who filed a claim in the bankruptcy. Dumas said Iowa's short statute of limitations for filing lawsuits related to child sexual abuse is a significant challenge for survivors seeking justice, as they may not be able to file until they connect their abuse to adult problems. Data from the U.S. Department of Justice suggests that 86% of child sexual abuse goes unreported altogether. When victims do report, a high percentage of them delay disclosure well into adulthood. So, in Iowa, because of the statute of limitations, the value of the claim is reduced by up to 70%, Dumas said. So, you know, a $600,000 claim would be worth only $180,000 simply because it happened in Iowa. Because his alleged abuse took place in Iowa, Vall estimates, due to how current state law figures into the settlement formula, he will receive between 30% and 40% of what he was initially entitled to as a claimant. Vall, an engineer, estimates over his lifetime he lost a couple of million dollars in wages due to crippling health issues he's coped with his entire adult life. And even then, people might only be paid 5 to 10% of the value because there's not enough money in the settlement fund, Dumas said. The reason that I oppose that plan and other survivors oppose the plan was because it simply does not put enough money into the pot to pay them what they would if they were allowed to go forward with their own cases in state court litigation, she said. The ultimate amount paid to claimants will be determined in part by how many claims are filed and allowed, according to the Scouting Settlement Trust. Until the trust knows the total number of allowed claims, it cannot determine how much can be distributed to an individual claimant, a news release states. The trustees overseeing the Boy Scouts set a May 31st deadline for all remaining claims and supporting documentation to be filed. Spokespeople for the Boy Scouts of America, contacted March 25th, had not answered questions as of Friday about the settlement agreement or the exact number of perpetrators and victims identified in Iowa in the bankruptcy case. Carl Bobus, a chief executive officer of the Boy Scouts of America Northeast Iowa Council, said the organization has implemented a number of protocols meant to better vet individuals put in leadership positions. We have an extremely rigorous vetting process, Bobus said in a statement. Some of the new protocols called barriers to abuse include no one-on-one contact between scouts and adults and require a minimum of 2 trained leaders at every scouting function. We take the safety of the youth extremely seriously, and I applaud our national office for entering into the settlement and doing things right by the victims, Bobus said. We believe them and feel their pain for their suffering. The Northeast Iowa Council includes Alma Key, Clayton, Delaware, and Dubuque counties in Iowa, and Joe Davies County in Illinois. Vall said he lived an almost normal life, but then his health deteriorated. He began experiencing crushing fatigue and muscle and joint pain that lasted decades and made it difficult to walk or stand. He said he developed headaches and was exhausted, Most days he felt like he had the flu. He worked only 2 to 3 hours a day after stopping full-time work in 1995, resulting in significant lost earning potential. Beginning in 2008, Vall said his energy slowly began to return after he built up his strength with regular walks. I remember sitting at my desk at work thinking I felt like I had a 50-pound backpack on my back, he said. And this was not occasional. This was what it felt like every day. He said he would sleep 10 hours at night, wake up, and feel like he had only slept an hour or not at all. I did live on the edge of suicide for decades, Vall said. He went to many different doctors, including at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. None could figure out the origins of his illness. The Mayo Clinic told him to stay on bed rest for 2 years. In 2023, a psychiatrist told Vall that childhood abuse might be the root cause of his health issues and diagnosed him with a somatoform disorder, according to the psychiatrist's report, which Vall shared. Quote, in people with somatoform disorders, the cause is thought to be intolerable psychological conflicts that are displaced into physical complaints, the report states. For some people, trying to wrestle with these psychological conflicts is a much safer way to address these psychological conflicts than trying to directly confront the conflicts. Senator Janet Peterson, Democrat of Des Moines, again this year introduced a bill that would have eliminated the statute of limitations to file civil claims for sex abuse, sex trafficking, and sexual exploitation. It would create a revival window for survivors to file claims and receive 100% of damages. Senate File 2233, however, never received a subcommittee hearing and failed to clear a legislative deadline in order to remain eligible for consideration this year. The bill is supported by the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault and the Iowa Trial Lawyers Association and League of Women Voters of Iowa. Peterson said lifting the law would allow more people to come forward and report abuse while also holding organizations accountable. Opponents expressed concerns that getting rid of the statute could make it difficult for organizations to defend themselves against decades-old cases. Brad Epperly is a lobbyist who represents Iowa's Defense Counsel Association, the only organization registered against SF-2233. Epperly said the association's opposition is not related to the Boy Scouts of America case. He said the group does not oppose eliminating the statute of limitations for perpetrators, but does oppose eliminating it for organizations and employers. If the statute of limitations was completely removed, it would be virtually impossible in some cases to defend a claim for third-party liability brought decades after the alleged occurrence, Epperly said. Dumas, the Oregon lawyer, counters that both sides bear the same burden and that victims should not be denied their right to pursue justice. States like Iowa should do everything they can to help those abused in Iowa get whatever justice they can get, she said. Not tip the scales in favor of any individual or organization that facilitated or allowed child sexual abuse on their watch. States, including Alabama, recently have passed laws lifting their statute of limitations for civil claims on sexual abuse to allow those abused in the Boy Scouts of America to file claims with the Scouting Settlement Trust. It's really painful, Peterson said, of frustration with the lawmakers' inaction to lift the statute of limitations. The laws didn't protect them when they were children and didn't allow them to come forward as grown-ups. It's just so wrong. There still remains an opportunity this legislative session to pass a leadership or appropriations bill, Senator Tim Kreienbrink and Representative Ann Mayer, both Republicans from Fort Dodge, said they are working with leadership in both chambers to craft a bill focused specifically on allowing survivors of sexual abuse in the Boy Scouts of America to take full advantage of the bankruptcy proceedings. Mayer said she anticipated including language similar to the Alabama legislation in the standings bill. If we can get good, tight language around it, it's very disturbing. The whole story is, Mayer said. I mean, this is top-tier abuse. I think my goal for this situation is to make the legislation very narrow and very tight in confronting this particular situation, Crayenbrink said. I feel that we now have the ball rolling, he said. We have leadership aware of it. We've got the governor's office aware of it. And you know, if there's something that we will do and we can do, then I will do everything I can to make it come to fruition. The next one is for April 1st. Gmail first thought to be April Fool's joke. Dateline San Francisco. Google co-founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin loved pulling pranks. So much so, they began rolling outlandish ideas every April Fool's Day not long after starting their company more than a quarter century ago. One year, Google posted a job opening for a Copernicus research center on the moon. Another year, the company said it planned to roll out a scratch-and-sniff feature on its search engine. The jokes were so consistently over the top that people learned to laugh them off as another example of Google mischief. And that's why Page and Brin decided to unveil something no one would believe was possible 20 years ago on April Fool's Day. It was Gmail, a free service boasting 1 gigabyte of storage per account, an amount that sounds almost pedestrian in an age of 1 terabyte iPhones. But it sounded like a preposterous amount of email capacity back then, enough to store about 13,500 emails before running out of space, compared to just 30 to 60 emails in the then-leading webmail services run by Yahoo and Microsoft. That translated into 250 to 500 times more email storage space. Besides the quantum leap in storage, Gmail also came equipped with Google's search technology so users could quickly retrieve a tidbit from an old email, photo, or other personal information stored on the service. It also automatically threaded together a string of communications about the same topic, so everything flowed together as if it was a single conversation. The original pitch we put together was all about the three S's, storage, search, and speed, said former Google executive Marissa Mayer, who helped design Gmail and other company products before later becoming Yahoo's CEO. It was such a mind-bending concept that shortly after the Associated Press published a story about Gmail late on the afternoon of April Fool's 2004, readers began calling and emailing to inform the news agency it had been duped by Google's pranksters. That was part of the charm, making a product that people won't believe is real. It's kind of changed people's perceptions about the kinds of applications that were possible within a web browser, former Google engineer Paul Buchheit recalled during a recent AP interview about his efforts to build Gmail. It took 3 years to do as part of a project called Caribou, a reference to a running gag in the Dilbert comic strip. There was something sort of absurd about the name Caribou. It just makes me laugh, said Buchheit, the 23rd employee hired at a company that now employs more than 180,000 people. The AP knew Google wasn't joking about the Gmail because an AP reporter had been abruptly asked to come down from San Francisco to the company's Mountain View, California headquarters to see something that would make the trip worthwhile. After arriving at a still-developing corporate campus that would soon blossom into what became known as the Googleplex, the AP reporter was ushered into a small office where Page was wearing an impish grin while sitting in front of his laptop computer. Page, then just 31 years old, proceeded to show off Gmail's sleekly designed inbox and demonstrated how quickly it operated within Microsoft's now-retired Explorer web browser. Andy pointed out there was no delete button feature in the main control window because it wouldn't be necessary, given Gmail had so much storage and could be so easily searched. I think people are really going to like this, Page predicted. As with so many other things, Page was right. Gmail now has an estimated 1.8 billion active accounts, each one now offering 15 gigabytes of free storage bundled with Google Photos and Google Drive. Even though that's 15 times more storage than Gmail initially offered, it's still not enough for many users who rarely see the need to purge their accounts, just as Google hoped. The digital hoarding of email, photos, and other content is why Google, Apple, and other companies now make money from selling additional storage capacity in their data centers. In Google's case, it charges anywhere from $30 annually for 200 gigabytes of storage to $250 annually for 5 terabytes of storage. Gmail's existence is also why other free email services and the internal email accounts that employees use on their jobs offer far more storage than was fathomed 20 years ago. Gmail was a game changer in several other ways while becoming the first building block in the expansion of Google's internet empire beyond its still dominant search engine. After Gmail came Google Maps and Google Docs with word processing and spreadsheet applications. Then came the acquisition of video site YouTube, followed by the introduction of the Chrome browser and the Android operating system that powers most of the world's smartphones. With Gmail's explicitly stated intention to scan the content of emails to get a better understanding of users' interests, Google also left little doubt that digital surveillance in pursuit of selling more ads would be part of its expanding ambitions. Although it immediately generated buzz, Gmail started out with a limited scope because Google initially only had enough computing capacity to support a small audience of users. When we launched, we only had 300 machines, and they were really old machines that no one else wanted, Buchheit said with a chuckle. We only had enough capacity for 10,000 users, which is a little absurd. But that scarcity created an air of exclusivity around Gmail that drove feverish demand for an elusive invitation to sign up. At one point, invitations to open a Gmail account were selling for $250 apiece on eBay. That became a bit like a social currency where people would go, "Hey, I got an email invite. You want one?" Buchheit said. Although signing up for Gmail became increasingly easier as more of Google's network of massive data centers came online, the company didn't begin accepting all comers to the email service until it opened the floodgates as a Valentine's Day present to the world in 2007. Now we'll turn to the news digest. Fast food wages get boost in California. Dateline Livermore, California. Most fast food workers in California will be paid at least $20 an hour beginning Monday when a new law is scheduled to kick in, giving more financial security to an historically low-paying profession while threatening to raise prices in a state already known for its high cost of living. Democrats in the state legislature passed the law last year as part of an acknowledgement that many of the more than 500,000 people who work in fast food restaurants are not teenagers earning spending money, but adults working to support their families. The law was supported by the trade association representing fast food franchise owners, but since it passed, many franchise owners have bemoaned the impact the law is having on them, especially during California's slowing economy. Russian missile strike hits Lviv infrastructure. Dateline Kiev, Ukraine. A Russian cruise missile strike in infrastructure in Ukraine's western Lviv region killed one man while another died in an attack in the northeast, officials said Sunday. The attack is Lviv's destroyed a building and sparked a fire, Governor Maxim Kostyev wrote in a social media app Telegram. He said rescue operations were being conducted. In the Kharkiv region, Governor Oleh Sinyahov said an air attack killed a 19-year-old man after a missile hit a gas station. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands in Ukraine's Odessa region were left without power Sunday after debris from a downed Russian drone caused a blaze at an energy facility. And briefly, in the lottery, the Powerball jackpot climbed to an estimated $975 million after no one matched the six numbers drawn Saturday night. continuing a nearly three-month stretch without a big winner. The winning numbers were 12, 13, 33, 50, 52, and the red Powerball, 23. Netanyahu. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said he was scheduled to undergo surgery on Sunday for a hernia. Netanyahu's office said the hernia was discovered during a routine checkup. Phoenix. For the first time since 1999, Phoenix had measurable rainfall on Easter Sunday. National Weather Service meteorologists also said Phoenix set a new daily rainfall record for March 31st with 0.28 inches, reaching that mark before noon Sunday. That topped the city's previous mark of 0.27 inches set in 1949. The Weather Service said the rainiest Easter on record for Phoenix was 1.19 inches on March 26, 1989. Ecuador. Armed gunmen attacked a group of people in Ecuador's coastal city of Guayaquil, killing 9 people and injuring 10 others, the Interior Ministry said, the latest in a string of violent incidents in the South American country. Fukushima. Japan said Sunday its experts have held talks with their Chinese counterparts to try to assuage Beijing's concern over the discharge of treated radioactive wastewater from the wrecked Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant into the sea. And Japan. Japanese government health officials on Sunday inspected a factory procuring health supplements linked to at least 5 deaths and the hospitalization of more than 100 others one day after the authorities investigated another plant that manufactured the product. Now we'll turn to the NBA games. Monday's games are Boston at Charlotte at 6 p.m., Brooklyn at Indiana at 6 p.m., Memphis at Detroit at 6 p.m., Portland at Orlando at 6 p.m., and Atlanta at Chicago at 7 p.m., Phoenix at New Orleans at 7 p.m. Tuesday's games are the L.A. Lakers at Toronto at 6 p.m., Milwaukee at Washington, 6 p.m., New York at Miami at 6:30 p.m., Oklahoma City at Philadelphia at 6:30 p.m., Houston at Minnesota at 7 p.m., Cleveland at Utah at 8 p.m., San Antonio at Denver at 8 p.m., Dallas at Golden State at 9 p.m., and the L.A. Clippers at Sacramento at 9 p.m. Now the games for the National Hockey League tonight. Colorado at Columbus at 6 p.m., Detroit at Tampa Bay at 6 p.m., Florida at Toronto at 6 p.m., the New York Islanders at Philadelphia at 6 p.m., Pittsburgh at the New York Rangers at 6 p.m., Edmonton at St. Louis at 8 p.m., Los Angeles at Winnipeg at 8 p.m., and Seattle at San Jose, 9:30 p.m. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Monday, April 1st, 2024. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening. Next, we'll have the Fort Dodge Messenger. Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, April 1st, 2024. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. The headline at the top of the paper is Another Opening. The Webster Theater and Hero expect to light up the downtown movie house in the fall. By Jane Curtis, Dateline, Webster City. If Jeff Pingle gets his wish, the Webster Theater will open in September. When it does, it will be 10 years since the downtown Webster City movie house reopened the first time. That first time, it stood empty, was because the parent business closed. This time, the popular theater was damaged by a fire next door. Flames from the roaring November 2023 blaze didn't damage the theater, but water and smoke did. The result was that most of the theater's interior, from the top to the bottom, had to be gutted. That work will continue into the middle of April, Pingle said. It could cost around $300,000, he estimated. When the demolition is complete, work will begin on another restoration. The money to do that will come from the theater's insurance. It will not come from the insurance that covered the building that burned. No, he wasn't negligent, Pingle said during a walkthrough of the gutted theater. So fundraising that was ongoing when the fire happened must shift into first gear again. Pingle is president of the nonprofit Hero Board, Help Entertain and Restore organization that was formed to pump new life into the iconic theater. He has reflexively pursued this latest necessary redo. Acoustic ceiling tiles, saturated with water, had crumbled into the seats with their commemorative plaques, which were removed and saved for fresh seats. The movie screen, which was slit and destroyed by vandals in the fall of 2017, once again headed to the trash. Those screens are damaged by large quantities of dust, let alone choking smoke and cascading water. Now the ceiling is down to the studs, the second story taken to the bare bones, too. The projection booth is emptied of its mechanics. The basement is dry. It was flooded when multiple fire departments converged on the day of the fire in their successful attempt to keep the blaze from spreading. Two rooms still show signs of life. The concession booth still glows green with vibrant paint, and stowed away in a small alcove adjacent to the projection booth are the remnants of another opening. The next story is titled, Duncombe Elementary Rolls Out the Red Carpet for Family Fun Night. Duncombe Elementary School and the Duncombe Booster Club are gearing up for the annual Duncombe Fun Night on Saturday. This carnival-style celebration from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. promises an afternoon brimming with games and community spirit, all while supporting the Booster Club, teachers, and students. Organized by the Booster Club, this family-oriented event will feature many activities. The afternoon will be filled with traditional carnival games and a cakewalk to a $1 raffle and a silent auction. Raffle highlights include a $200 Quickstar gift card, a 55-inch smart TV, and family adventures like passes to King's Point, the Blank Park Zoo, and the Science Center of Iowa. The silent auction includes unique experiences like rides to school with the Fort Dodge Police and Fire Departments, and Green Bay Packers football signed by the team. Principal Ryan Flaherty and club president Lindsay Steffen share their thoughts on the event and the countless Booster Club members' dedication and hard work. These parents have worked tirelessly behind the scenes. Flaherty spoke of the deep collaboration between Duncombe Elementary and the Booster Club, underscoring how events like these are pivotal in cultivating a welcoming and vibrant school community. Fun Night is more than just an event, he said. It's a powerful reminder of our students that school is not only a place for education, but also for joy, community, and forming enduring friendships. Steffen, the Booster Club president, outlined what attendees can look forward to at the event. We're thrilled to offer an array of activities from traditional carnival games to a new art project station sponsored by the Blandon Art Museum, she said. There's something for everyone. Steffen also emphasized the critical role of Fun Night as the club's primary fundraising initiative, with proceeds being used to enrich the educational and social experience of Duncombe students and staff. This event allows us to provide essential resources for our classrooms, fund educational field trips, and host family engagement events that strengthen our community, she added. The success of Fun Night heavily relies on its contribution of volunteers. The Booster Club is actively seeking donations of cakes and cupcakes for the family favorite cakewalk and monetary or prize donations from the local business community. For those looking for other ways to support the event, purchasing $1 raffle tickets is a fantastic way for everyone to pitch in, Steffen said. Not only does it offer the chance to win some amazing prizes, but it's also a direct way to support our students and staff, she said. Every ticket sold brings us closer to our goal of enhancing the educational experience at Duncombe. Steffen has been overwhelmed by the level of support and engagement from the broader community. She spoke highly of the local businesses whose generosity has been pivotal to the event's success. Our engagement from our wider community has been truly overwhelming, Stefan said. Local businesses have stepped up in a big way, generously contributing donations for the raffle and silent auction. Their support is instrumental in making Fun Night not just a possibility, but a surefire success. According to Stefan, this influx of community support showcases the deep connection between the school and the surrounding community. And the last story from the front page is titled, Good Friday Ends Well for Trapped Blue Heron by Jane Curtis, Dateline Webster City. It was a good Friday for the blue heron trapped in a fishing line on the Boone River near Kendall Young Park on the north side of Webster City. Fortunately, it was a good Friday to call in the Webster City Fire Department. It was asked for help about 2 p.m. A rescue team was put together and responded to the area, Fire Chief Chuck Stansfield said in a media release. The team consisted of Lieutenant Phil Jessen, Lieutenant Kenrick Weinscheck, Firefighter Dakota Feichert, and Firefighter Michael Lehman. They found the heron entangled in a fishing line and a tree on the river. He said the team put together some ideas to be able to cut the bird free with the tool they created. A video shows Lehman, with the team as backup, reaching the line with the creature tool, the creative tool. Once the line was removed, the entrapped and bedraggled bird appeared to know instantly that it was free. The blue heron flew away with what appeared to be no lasting injuries, Stansfield reported. All members returned to service. Now turning to page 2, from our files column, this is April 2009 with a picture of Randy Kuhlman, who was named the Chief Executive Officer of the United Way and the Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa after serving as interim CEO since September 2008. And in the Messenger poll, this week's question is, do you plan to travel to view the solar eclipse on April 8th? And then we have pictures of people participating in rocket science. Teams used their heads during the Webster City High School Rocketry Club trivia night Friday at the high school. The top picture shows Rocco Miller as he confers with his fellow team member, Mertz member, Alan Anderson, and Trenton Mossman, all of Webster City. And then there's a picture of the evening's MCs, who were Braden Schnell of Webster City and Owen Galantine of Webster City. Schnell is the safety officer for the club. Then the family circus team members were Patrick, Angela, and Rogan Nepereni, Hank Christensen, Savannah Askland, all of Webster City, and Garrett and Chloe Ahmet of Stratford from left to right. And they participated in the family circus team. And then the rocketry team captain, Jaden Elledge, discusses what is happening this spring with the club. Elledge is a senior at WCHS and plans to continue his interest in the fall, having been accepted into the aerospace engineering program at Iowa State University. Now we'll turn to the In Brief column on page 3. Webster City's cat hut will potty on for the paws. Dateline Webster City. The Cat Hut in Webster City is partnering with animal welfare organizations throughout the United States and beyond for the 2024 Shelter Slumber Party, spelled P-A-W-T-Y. Hundreds of animal lovers will spend 24 hours side-by-side Saturday with shelter pets to raise funds and awareness for community animals. That's right, the Cat's Hut's most dedicated supporters will spend 24 hours eating, sleeping, and pottying with the shelter's amazing cats and kittens while raising money to support its programs. We're super excited about this unique event, especially heading into kitten season, Board President Monica Becker said. We already have our first two mamas with newborns, and another litter is on the way. It's going to be a busy year. Adoptions have increased 93% since opening the Cat Hut in 2022, and we're anticipating even more in 2024. Participants have already begun fundraising efforts online at shelterslumberparty.com and Pawty is spelled P-A-W-T-Y. Cat Hut 2024, and all proceeds will go towards animal care costs. The Cat Hut invites you to stop by to meet the fun-loving Pajama Pawty volunteers and some adorable adoptables during the Pawty's extended open hours, 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. on Saturday and 9 a.m. to noon on Sunday. For more information, visit cathutmanager@gmail.com or call the Cat Hut at 515-667-2759. Then this, WCCT to hold auditions for Beauty and the Beast, Jr. Dateline, Webster City. Young people from Webster City and surrounding areas are invited to be part of A Tale as Old as Time as Webster City Community Theater presents Disney's Beauty and the Beast, Jr. this summer. Auditions will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Sunday and from 6 to 8 p.m. April 8th at Trinity Lutheran Church, 1229 Kathy Lane, Webster City. Cast members must be 18 years of age and younger. The production features 11 primary roles, including Belle, the Beast, Maurice, Gaston, LeFou, Lumiere, Cogsworth, Mrs. Potts, Chip, Babette, and Madame de la Grande Bouche, and 25 supporting roles. Lindsay Henderson and Dane Barner are directors for the production, June 21st and 23rd, and June 28th and 30th. Karina Murray and Katie Hildahl are the production coordinators. Now we'll turn to the opinion page, and this, keep Iowa's roads safe during planting. Drivers must share the road with big farm machines. We are quickly approaching one of those times of the year when big, slow-moving farm vehicles rumble out onto roadways dominated by faster-paced traffic. That shouldn't be a surprise to anyone who lives in farm country. Even so, all of us should pay special heed to safety considerations as we share the roads with agricultural vehicles heading to the fields. Iowa has been doing a good job of keeping accidents involving farm vehicles to a minimum. According to data from the Iowa Department of Transportation, fatalities and major injuries resulting from such accidents have been on the decline in recent years. That's encouraging news. Keeping that favorable trend headed in the right direction is an important goal as this year's planting gets underway. The Iowa DOT has the following advice for motorists. Be alert and always watch for slow-moving vehicles. Be patient. Don't assume the farmer can move aside to let you pass. The shoulder may be unable to support a heavy farm vehicle. Slow down as soon as you see the triangle-shaped red and fluorescent orange slow-moving vehicle emblem. Those are sensible suggestions that everyone should follow. It's also important for people operating farm vehicles to take responsibility for their role in preventing accidents. The DOT has the following tips for them. Make your intentions known when turning by using signal lights or the appropriate hand signal in advance of the turn. Drive slowly. Drive slow-moving vehicles in the right-hand lane as close to the edge of the roadway as safely possible. Traveling half on the shoulder may cause motorists to risk passing in a dangerous situation. And don't encourage or signal motorists to pass. Pull over where it is safe and let traffic go by. If farm vehicle operators and the rest of us adhere carefully to these admonitions, many tragedies can be averted. The key is for everyone to make safety a priority. And then we have this opinion piece by Mike Sexton, who is a state representative, Republican of Rockwell City, and he represents Calhoun, Pocahontas, and Sac counties, plus western Webster County. And it's titled, Ag and Veterans Issues Come Before the Iowa House. We have now been here for 12 weeks. We have 2 weeks left. We received our budget targets today. Budget subcommittees will start meeting to get their budgets put together for the full Appropriations Committee. This will finalize the state budget on the House side, anyway. Interestingly enough, getting the budget done each year is really the only thing the legislature is required to do. So the process is started, which is a good sign. It sounds like we are not going to have joint target numbers with the Senate, which means each side will do their own budget, and this will only add more time to the session. In the House, we believe it can't always be about cutting spending. At some point, you need to spend money to take care of things that need to be taken care of. Once again, I'm working on more funding for our state highways in Northwest Iowa. As I talk to other rural legislators from across the state, this issue is not just in my district. This is a statewide problem, and it's getting worse every year that we continue to neglect our roads. Back home, the ewes are getting fat, and our first lambs are due April 19th. In the next couple of weeks, we will be getting ready to AI ewes for fall lambing. Taxes, HJR 2006, making it harder to raise taxes. With the Republican trifecta in the Capitol, we have been focused on lowering the tax burden on Iowans, but we know many of our colleagues on the other side of the aisle would be raising taxes if they were in our position. The decision to raise taxes should not be made lightly. It should be difficult to take additional money out of the paychecks of hardworking Iowans. This week, we passed a joint resolution to send a constitutional amendment to the ballot for Iowans to vote on. This constitutional amendment would require a two-thirds majority vote in the legislature to increase income tax or to create a new tax. Because this bill deals with a constitutional amendment, the legislative body would need to pass it again in the next General Assembly. Then it would become a ballot measure for all Iowans to weigh in on. We heard claims on the House floor that this bill would be detrimental to Iowa's future. However, this policy of requiring two-thirds majority to raise taxes is not unheard of. At least 16 other states have a similar or more restrictive policy, many of which are blue states. Ag. The big news this week in ag was that on Monday, the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship issued a press release in which Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig commented on the announcement made by the United States Department of Agriculture regarding the detection of highly pathogenic avian influenza in dairy cattle in Texas and Kansas. Quote, "Our team is actively monitoring this evolving situation regarding the news that dairy cattle in Texas and Kansas have tested positive for highly pathogenic avian influenza. We are communicating with the USDA, other states, and industry stakeholders while we learn more and there are other new developments. Protecting Iowa's livestock farmers from foreign animal disease has been and will continue to be one of my top priorities as secretary," unquote. This is the first case of a mammal coming down with this disease. We will watch this carefully to make sure we do all we can as a state to protect our livestock industry. And veterans. This week, the House passed House File 2663 unanimously. This bill transfers $300,000 from the lottery fund to provide each county with funds to be used for national training for veteran service officers. $2.5 million is annually allocated to the Veterans Trust Fund from the lottery. This bill will allow $300,000 of that to be used for VSO training. $500,000 will continue to be allowed to be spent annually by the Commission on Veterans Affairs. There is currently $40.5 million in the Veterans Trust Fund with interest deposits over $100,000 per month. The House also sent House File 259 to the governor. This bill includes provisions to ensure that Iowa's veterans service officers are certified and have access to the Veterans Benefits Management System within a year of being hired. Iowa's veteran service officers are the first stop for any Iowa veteran that is seeking the benefits owed to them for their service. We have three obituaries. Ruth Bry Walker. Ruth Bry Walker of Fort Dodge passed away on Friday, March 29, 2024, at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Home. Graveside services will be held at 10 a.m. Wednesday, April 3, 2024, at the Blossom Hill Cemetery. Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Service is entrusted with the arrangements. Lori Jackson, Lake City. Funeral, 10:30 a.m. Wednesday at the Lampy and Powers Funeral Home. Visitation, 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday at the Lampy and Powers Funeral Home. Burial in the Lake City Cemetery. And Elaine Carlson, Fort Dodge. Elaine Carlson, 82, of Fort Dodge, passed away on Wednesday, March 27th at the Simpson Health Center at Friendship Haven. A celebration of life will be held on Saturday, April 6, 2024, at 11 a.m. at the Tompkins Celebration Center at Friendship Haven, Fort Dodge, Iowa. Visitation will be prior to the service from 10 a.m. until 11. Arrangements have been entrusted with the Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services. Now turning to the sports section, Fort Dodge Girls Golf, the season preview by Eric Pratt. The Fort Dodge girls golf team is playing the long game in 2024. The Dodgers know they have plenty of work to do, both at practice and in meets, to reach their competitive goals this season. Head coach Angela Denklau is still preaching patience and incremental progress, given there are no seniors on the roster. "We're working on being more consistent on the course and in our approach," said Denklau, who is in her second year at the helm. "We focused on a lot of different things in the preseason, indoors and on mats, but it's much different when you have to navigate the physical and mental demands of a live varsity meet. With that being said, we're also emphasizing the importance of having fun. Golf is all about building relationships with your teammates and with others, so we can't get so caught up in the technicalities that we aren't able to keep the bigger picture in mind. Finding that balance is so important because golf can be an emotionally challenging sport." Top player Braxton Decklau is back for her third spring at the varsity level. Decklau, a junior, had a nine-hole average of 48.2 in 2023, with a low round of 43. Junior Felicity Strain, sophomore Brielle Crouch, and sophomore Alani Krause also returned to the lineup. "All of them, whether they're shooting in the 40s or the 60s, have to put in more time either on the range, the putting and chipping greens, or the course beyond what is required," Denklau said. "When you're rebuilding the way we are, any extra practice makes a difference. I think the other thing every golfer faces is not letting a bad shot turn into a bad hole, or a bad hole turn into a bad round. Regardless of your talent level, you're going to do some things on the course you'd like to have back, but you have to keep moving forward, persevere, and fight through the adversity." Junior Gabby Santana Bass and freshman Emma Lloyd and Allie Louvain round out the roster. "Felicity, Alani, and Brielle are all making progress," Denklau said. "So are Gabby, Emma, and Aaliyah, relative to their experience levels. It's just a matter of building up that level of consistency." Denklau and FDSH boys head coach Nick Vinson are planning to visit the middle school on April 19th and get kids excited about golf and make sure they see it as a lifelong sport that can also be played even with other athletics and activities on your plate. "The more exposure you get through junior programs and tournaments, the better. We have to introduce kids to these opportunities well before high school." Fort Dodge opens its season with home meets this Tuesday against Marshalltown and next Tuesday versus Humboldt. The Dodgers' annual home invitational is May 10th at the FDCC. 2024 Fort Dodge girls golf roster. Juniors are Braxton Denklau, Felicity Strain, Gabby Santana Bass. Sophomores are Brielle Crouch and Alani Krause. And freshmen are Emma Lloyd and Aaliyah Louvain. The schedule: April 2nd against Marshalltown, April 9th against Humboldt, April 16th at Ames, April 23rd Waterloo East, and April 30th at Mason City. May 7th IAC North Invitational, and May 10th Fort Dodge Invitational. And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Monday, April 1st, 2024. I'm your reader, Catherine Moyers. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.